This is the Ready for Takeoff podcast, episode 89. My name is George Nolly, and today we're talking to Tom Bunn. But first, let me tell you about our sponsor, the Hamfist Novel Series. If you like aviation combat action based on real events, you're really going to enjoy the Hamfist Novel Series, available on Amazon and Smashwords, and we have a special offer in our show notes. So, fasten your seatbelts and get ready for takeoff. I'm joined today by Tom Bunn, a former Air Force fighter pilot, an award-winning race car driver, an airline pilot for Pan Am, an airline pilot for United, and most importantly, the developer of the SOAR program for Fear of Flying. So, Tom, it's such a pleasure to have you aboard.
George, thanks for having me join you today. It's a great pleasure to be here.
You're welcome. So tell us how you got your start in flying. Was it before the Air Force?
Well, you know, back in, I grew up in North Carolina in the 40s, and when the Second World War was over, the guys coming back, you know, some guys were soldiers on the ground. They didn't get much of attention, but the people who were the pilots, everybody in town turned out, man, they were heroes. I thought, I'd like some of that. So I was, from that point on, interested in becoming a pilot.
And did you take flying lessons before the Air Force?
No, I had a couple of rides with local pilots who had come back from World War II and, you know, Piper Cub. But I went into aviation cadets after college, and then went to F-100 training.
And you sound a little modest. You were number one in your pilot training class, right? That's how you got the hunt.
Yeah, that was the way it worked, because if you... whoever was number one got your first choice, and whoever was down at the bottom got whatever was left, which was probably B-47s.
Right. So where did you fly the F-100?
Well, training was at Luke Air Force Base in Phoenix, and then Las Vegas at Nellis, and then I went overseas to Germany, Spangdahlem Air Force Base, which is in the Eifel area. It's kind of near Trier, near the Luxembourg border.
Now, was there a unit transition to the F-105?
Yeah, after a couple of years, we got the F-105. So I had about half the time I was in the 100 in Germany and half the time in the 105.
Now, while you were there, how did it happen that you got interested in race car driving?
Well, once again, it was one of those things about, you know, fighter pilots tend to think, you know, you have to be the best at everything. And it wasn't enough just to be flying the F-100 somehow. I still felt like, you know, there were these guys who were famous, like John Surtees and Sterling Moss. And I just wondered, you know, if they were, you know, some sort of superhuman guys. And so, as you probably know, fighter pilots are pretty competitive. So I ended up buying a race car and trying that for a couple of years. And it was kind of satisfying, because that was another area where, you know, with the competition, you know, you could get the idea of how you stacked up with other people.
Now, did you get out of the Air Force when you moved back from Europe?
Yeah, I got out in 65. What was happening was the guys who were rotating back to the States were telling us that they were getting pretty crummy duty. They were getting sent temporarily to places like Adana, Turkey for half the year. And so they said, if you think it's bad in Germany being on alert half the time, you know, don't even come back to the U.S. So that's when I got out and started looking for an airline job.
Just curious, did you ship your race car back with you?
Yeah, shipped the race car back. Also, another car. I had a 300 SL Gullwing. I shipped that back to the States.
Oh, do you still have that?
No, I sold that.
Wow.
There was a time when it looked like the classic car market had kind of peaked. That was not true, but I sold it. And if I had it today, it certainly would have been better off.
Oh, yes, absolutely. So was Pan Am your first choice?
Well, yeah, it was. And I applied there initially. They said they didn't need anybody when I first got out of the Air Force, but a few months later, they started hiring again. And so I went to work at Pan Am in 1965 in the fall.
Did you have your civilian certificates before you got out of the Air Force?
I'm not sure. I don't know if I did or not. I probably got them when I applied for Pan Am.
So when you started with Pan Am, what equipment were you on?
Well, what they told us we were going to do would be flying DC-8s, and it got to the day we showed up for first day at work there, and they started giving us these nav manuals. They said they had thought they were going to be able to fly the DC-8 to Africa on Doppler radar, but the FAA didn't approve it. The surface of the Earth was, or the sea was too flat to pick up the radar all the time. So they needed navigators. We had to learn how to do celestial navigation. So that was the first job at Pan Am. And then after that, co-pilot on the DC-8.
How long were you a navigator?
About a year and a half.
Uh-huh. Wow.
Yeah.
Wow, that's interesting. So then you were a co-pilot on the DC-8. How long did you fly that?
About 5 years, and then switched to the 707 co-pilot. And it took quite a long time to get to be a captain at Pan Am. In fact, it never made it there. I was there for almost 20 years still flying co-pilot. And then you can see the handwriting on the wall with Pan Am. So when we had a chance, about 420 of us had a chance to switch to United. So most of us who had that opportunity did. And there got to be first captain on a 727 and then the 757/767 dual qualified.
Very neat. So what did you retire off of?
767, yeah. Uh-huh. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Now, tell us about how you got involved in fear of flying education.
Well, we had a guy at Pan Am. His name was Truman Cummings. Called him Slim Cummings. And back in the mid-70s, Slim was interested in hypnotism and smoke enders and different programs like that. He had a couple of friends who were afraid of flying, and he tried hypnotism on them. Didn't work. So he just spent some time with them, talked to them about how flying works, took them out to an airplane, got them familiar with the plane in different ways, and took some flights with them and got them flying. So he was in Miami at the time. He went to the chief pilot in Miami and said, you know, I think we should have a fear of flying course. And the chief pilot said, sounds like a good idea, but Slim, you know, should be a psychologist. Well, back in those days, you could pay the state of Florida $5 and you were a psychologist. So
really, just print up business cards and you become one.
Yeah, so Slim had the chutzpah to say, but I am a psychologist. So that's how the course at Pan Am started. So he ran it starting in 75. I worked as a volunteer with him for a couple of years in the early 80s. And it was a good program as far as it went, but there were still a lot of people. We'd go with them on the graduation flights. They were doing the relaxation exercises we taught them. And still, they were having a panic attack. So I said, we ought to add some cognitive behavioral therapy stuff to it. So it never happened. So then in 82, I set up SOAR and added cognitive, thinking that was going to take care of it. It helped some people. But the problem is that there are a lot of people whose level of arousal or their level of alarm or gets just skyrocket so quickly that on an airplane, particularly in turbulence, that they have no cognition left to do cognitive tools with. So they just went right up to panic. And it took years to find something that would work. And what it took was finding something that would work completely automatically based in the part of the brain that's not susceptible to stress hormones, which is unconscious part of the brain.
Uh-huh. Now, when did you become a licensed clinical social worker? And I assume you did that to further this program, right?
Yeah, you know, really when I first started working with Slim, I thought it was mostly about helping people realize how safe it is. But then as I became more involved with it, I realized that it's mostly psychology. You know, it's pretty easy to explain flying is remarkably safe. It's just that people don't know how to control their feelings. Well, a lot of people don't know how to control their feelings. Unless you're on your own 2 feet, if something interests you, to be able to walk over toward it and engage it, and if something worries you, to back away from it. And if you don't have that kind of control, you don't feel like you have control. And the airplane takes that away. Now, there are some more sophisticated ways to control emotions, but those require more development. This one is pretty built into us, and if that's the only one we've got, being a passenger doesn't work out very well. Uh-huh. So when I realized that there was so much psychology involved, I started going to some institutes in New York, and then they said, well, if you're going to keep trying to go to these specialty institutes for psychology, you need to get licensed. So late 80s, I got licensed as a therapist and then continued that quest of digging into psychology at a deeper level.
Uh-huh. So now you've helped, how many thousands have you helped so far?
We figure there's roughly 10,000 people who've been through the program.
Wow. So. That's tremendous. Now, tell me about writing the book.
Yeah, well, I started writing it several times, and it seems that every time I started, I learned something new and thought, I got to start all over again. But finally, things kind of got stable, and I started really getting into it. And originally wrote it more as a book for therapists. There's a guy who runs the Milton Erickson Hypnosis Institute out in Phoenix, who is a publisher, and he said, well, look, I'll publish the book, but you'll do better if you rewrite it, set it up not so much for therapists with all these footnotes and psychological jargon stuff, but you make it more for just the ordinary person. And that way you can get it on the shelves at just regular bookstores. You'll do a lot better. So that's what I did.
Now, I'm curious, are people who are interested in becoming like private pilots in general aviation, do they have fear of flying, and do they go to you also?
Occasionally, because even though you're in control, there are some situations where you don't feel that comfortable as a pilot. I got to go step it back here. You know, I mentioned that this basic way to feel in control is if you're on your own 2 feet, so I'm had control of the situation. The way that we develop unconscious control is based on our relationships with other people. If you think about why infants spend so many years dependent, the brain is being programmed in those first few years of life. And one of the main things that needs to be programmed in is how to get calmed down. There's obviously a lot of things that upset us, but we need to calm down in order to be able to effectively deal with them. So first, your mom's doing it for you. When you're a little kid, you get upset. Your mom says, oh, I see what's the problem. You know, it's going to be okay in just a minute. Either it's just going to be okay, or I'm going to fix it. So if you have that happen literally a few thousand times as a kid, it becomes something that is built in as an expectation. And then it gets to the point where even if your mom's not there, you expect that things are going to work out okay. And that gives you a way to build in some calming, some way to regulate feelings, even when you're not in control, even when you're not able to escape. So what we needed to do was to add that ability in for people who hadn't had that benefit when they were little kids.
Wow. Now, I'm just curious, do you see a spike in inquiries after high-profile news events like the German Wings crash and like what's going on with the drag gate at the United, actually Republic Airlines event of recently? Do you see a lot of people having anxiety about flying?
Well, I don't think that one, the most recent dragging situation had that kind of an effect. People are mostly concerned about turbulence because, you know, what happens is, let's say you're up on the ladder and you're painting the ceiling, concentrating on it. Doesn't matter how deep in concentration you are. If you lose your balance, you're going to get a shot of stress hormones. It's a part of the brain called the amygdala, which is going to release stress hormones. So when you get into turbulence in an airplane, doesn't matter how much relaxation exercises you're doing, doesn't matter how you're focusing or trying to keep your mind off the flight, when that plane drops, the amygdala is going to have this knee-jerk reaction and give you stress hormones, and it's not just one drop, it's one after another, and it builds up to the point that the stress hormones reach a level where the person's ability to think clearly and say, well, this is just turbulence, it's fried. and they begin to believe that the plane is falling out of the sky. So it's the past accidents where they believe that the plane fell out of the sky that's the main problem, and that would take you back to Air France 447. That was the one that drove people crazy. Plus the Malaysian plane that they never found. That one really bothered people because just the idea of being totally lost, just vanished from the face of the earth, that really bothered people a lot. Wow. Those two are the main ones.
Right. And putting it in perspective of how many people die each year of from auto accidents and things like that, I assume that doesn't really do very much for them.
No, it doesn't. In fact, I think the statistics makes things a little worse when somebody says, but look, don't you realize that the chances of being in a fatal crash is, they say these days, 1 in 50 million? And that statistic may help some people, but a person who's anxious about flying, 50 million doesn't compute. But that one, that computes.
Yeah.
And that's the one that crashed. And the other one is them. So that the statistics just links them right into the plane that crashed.
Well, you know, that makes sense because we know that that's about the same statistics as winning the lottery. And we all go and buy lottery tickets.
Yeah, exactly.
Right. Now, is SOAR an acronym for something?
Yeah, initially we called it Seminars on Aero Anxiety Relief. And I just like the idea of SOAR, as like, you know, a bird using the turbulence to fly higher. And I thought that's a nice way to conceptualize the difficulties that a person has to see if they can use their difficulty with flying to be able to lift themselves into making the whole world open for them.
Uh-huh.
So I wanted to call it that. And so we just looked for some words that wasn't an acronym.
Now, so I'm also curious, do you get many people, I guess this is a dumb question, but do you get many people who are like general aviation pilots who have a fear of flying as passengers?
Not as passengers, but I've had a few who became anxious because they don't have quite enough of that built-in calming that we talked about, how you develop it when you're a kid. One in particular, that situation is stall series. When you bring the nose up, 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 and you lose sight of the horizon. The whole Earth, in fact, if you get the nose up high enough, the Earth disappears. If you go back to that basic idea that the Earth is what gives you control, being on your own two feet, that's what gives you control. Okay, so you as a passenger get on the airplane. Well, let's say you get in a car. You don't have the ability to use your own two feet in the car, but the Earth is right there. But in an airplane, you get higher and higher above the Earth. The higher you go, the farther you are from where you have control. And so when you, as a passenger, can't see the ground, it's almost like it disappears. And so the source of your control no longer exists. That's what happens for not very many, but a few private pilots. When the nose is up very, very high and they lose the horizon, their sense of orientation and safety disappears. Seems strange, but it happens in a few cases.
Now, when I was a kid, I had an aunt and uncle who would never fly on the same flight. They would go to Europe on separate airplanes just because they thought, you know, if the airplane crashes, at least the kids will have one parent left. Do you have a lot of people like that come to you?
I hear it once in a while, not as much as it used to be. I think people in that sense have realized that it would be making a lot more sense to go in separate cars to the supermarket, you know.
But yeah, that's right.
Because if you go down to look at the statistics, when you drive 3 miles, that's the equivalent in terms of fatality of going coast to coast in an airplane.
Wow.
So I don't hear that very much. I hear people sometimes saying that they are concerned about going off on a flight and leaving the kids at home, and what if something happens? So I try to tell them, you're not being selfish. You're actually protecting yourself. If you stop your daily routine and stop driving your car and get on the plane, you're actually safer. So don't feel bad about it. Now, that kind of gives them permission then to move into, okay, how can I control the feelings? So that's that's the next thing.
Uh-huh. Now, if people want to learn more about you and your program, can you, and of course, we're going to have this in the show notes also, but can you tell us your website?
It's fearofflying.com. Pretty easy to remember.
Wow, that's good. Yeah, that is a great URL to have.
Well, by the way, you're talking about private pilots, and I just wanted to bring in something because I know a lot of your audience is private pilots. And when I work with a private pilot, what I want to do is to give him a way to shut down his fear system when he's in the cockpit. So I say, okay, someday when you're not flying, go out to the airplane with your checklist and get in the cockpit. The first thing you touch on the checklist, I'm not sure what it is. I looked at a small plane checklist for a while, but let's say, for example, is the throttle in the cutoff position. So I said, okay, think of a moment when you were with your wife in a romantic setting. Because in certain romantic situations, you produce a hormone called oxytocin, shuts the fear system down. So I said, when you look at that throttle, look at the handle and see if you can picture your wife's face in that romantic situation, that sexual situation, so that when you touch the throttle, you are reminded of her. And then you go to the ignition switch and you check the position of the ignition switch. So you go through the whole checklist, item by item, item, linking a loved person to every item in there, so that gives the person a way to stay producing the hormone, oxytocin, that shuts the fear system down as they do the checklist. And then you run it farther as they go through the checklist to take off and fly around. So you want to be able to produce oxytocin throughout their whole flight.
Wow, that is very cool. Now, as we wrap up, what advice would you have for someone who's just starting out as a pilot?
Well, I don't know if I can suggest anything particular for feeling more comfortable than that. Let me put it this way. We know of six situations that produce oxytocin. And if you can link oxytocin production to the things you're going to be doing in the cockpit, just like I described, that'll help keep your fears under control. And the six things are, one of them is not going to work for guys, will work maybe for a woman who's had children. Nursing a child produces the most oxytocin.
Right.
Nature wants to shut down the fear system so that mothers doesn't get anxious. She should stop feeding the baby and do something else. Then oxytocin is also produced in good sexual foreplay so that fear of getting physically close goes away. It's also produced at orgasm and here for a different purpose, for bonding, so that if the two people do produce a child, then because of the bonding that happens between the two people, better chance, nature kind of figured it out, better chance they'll stick together and there'll be two people to take care of the baby. Also, when you see a newborn child, same thing. You feel bonded to the child, feel like taking care of it. Now, the other two, one of them is interesting. If you have a dog and you gaze into your dog's eyes, your dog looks at you like a lover should, total devotion. That produces oxytocin. And there's a new one that was discovered this year that if you get a long hug, very, very solid hug for 30 seconds or longer, that produces oxytocin. So any of those, a new pilot could link to the things that they're going to run into as they do their pre-flight, as they do their checklist before the start engine, as they do their taxi out, take off, and come in for landing. So if you can link the entire flight to oxytocin production, that'll take care of it.
Wow, that is fascinating. Now, one last thing. Is there anything on your aviation bucket list?
For myself, no, I don't get a chance to even fly as a passenger anymore. We spend a lot of time here taking care of my wife's grandson. So we're pretty much stay-at-home people these days.
Uh-huh. Well, I really appreciate, and I know you're busy with this, with your program, so I really appreciate you taking the time today, Tom. But most important, I want to thank you for your service in the Air Force.
Thanks very much, George.
Let me
just add one more thing that if anybody's interested and would like to actually talk about it, every Wednesday we have a chat from 9 until 11 Eastern, and we have a group phone session from 10 until 11. So if you go to the website, fearflying.com, and look under the talk and read heading, you can find that. And That would be a chance for anybody who wants to talk about aviation from any point of view, about fear of flying or some other point of view, that can join in the chat. It would be great to have them.
Excellent. Well, thanks again, Tom.
Thank you, George.
You're welcome.
Thanks again for listening. Subscribe now to the Ready for Takeoff podcast on iTunes or Stitcher Radio, and please rate us and post a review on the iTunes store. For show notes, resources, and more, head over to readyfortakeoffpodcast.com.